Before beginning, I'd like to call your attention to a little document that tells us something of the nature of subversion and how subversives have always used the familiar and patriotic themes, phrases, and expressions as an entree to people. In June 1917, a People's Council of America was organized, which was modeled on exactly the same basis as the Council of Workmen's and Soldiers' Soviet of Russia. But it was organized 4 months before the Soviets began their existence. This Marxist group had as its executive secretary, Louis Lochner, its financial secretary, Rebecca Shelley, and the name of the treasurer is very interesting, Dr. David Starr Jordan, president of Stanford at the time. Among the members of the committee were Max Eastman, Eugene Debs, Morris Pilquist, James Marr, and the Rabbi Judah L. Magnus. Now, in August of that year, 1917, Roger Baldwin wrote to Lochner stating, "Do steer away from making it look like a socialist enterprise. Too many people have already gotten the idea that it is nine-tenths a socialist movement. Do get into the movement just as strong as possible, the leaders in the labor circles. We want also to look like patriots in everything we do. We want to get a lot of good flags, talk a good deal about the Constitution and what our forefathers wanted to make of this country, and to show that we are the folks that really stand for the spirit of our institutions." Lochner replied, "I agree with you that we should keep proclaiming our loyalty and patriotism. I will see to it that we have flags and similar paraphernalia." Government of the people, by the people, for the people. This term has been so extensively used by subversives that it is difficult now to understand what the meaning of this expression originally was. When Lincoln used it in its final and decisive form, he was using an expression that was more or less current in the United States for a few generations. It is now commonly taken to mean three things. First, the doctrine of popular sovereignty. Second, the concept of democracy and the democratic state. Third, it is taken to mean the equation of government with the state. Now, all these popular meanings of government of, by, and for the people are myth. Constitutionalism is government by law. And constitutionalism is a product of the colonial period. It is basically a Christian concept. And basic to the idea of constitutionalism is the belief in a higher law, the law of God. This is not merely my say-so. One of our leading modern liberals, Edward S. Carwin, in his book, The Higher Law Background of U.S. Constitutionalism, has admitted that basic to the document, the U.S. Constitution, is the belief that there is a higher law, the law of God, and that this law is the Supreme Court above and over the federal government and all human orders. Constitutionalism is a restraint placed upon the federal union. And the people are also restrained in part by the Constitution, but basically by the civil and criminal law of the states. So that, according to constitutionalism, neither the federal government nor the people are to be trusted. constitutionalism, as a result, is hostile to popular sovereignty, it is hostile to democracy, and it is hostile to the equation of government with the state. A basic premise of constitutionalism is that in neither the federal government nor in man do we trust. In God we trust. Now, to examine these three concepts a little more closely. First of all, the doctrine of popular sovereignty. We have said that it is not a part of our constitutional heritage. The very word and idea of sovereignty is bypassed by the U.S. Constitution. And this is a deliberate and a significant omission. Father John Courtney Murray has written, "The term legal sovereignty makes no sense in America, where sovereignty, if the alien term must be used, is purely political. The United States has a government, or better, a structure of governments operating on different levels. The American state has no sovereignty in the classical continental sense." Then a very prominent and brilliant English historian has called attention to the same fact. Dr. Pollard has said, "The colonies had been as anxious to get rid of James II in 1688 as they were to be free of Parliament in 1776. Their fundamental objection was to any sovereignty vested in any state whatever, even in their own. Americans may be defined as that part of the English-speaking world which has instinctively revolted against the doctrine of the sovereignty of the state, and has, not quite successfully, striven to maintain that attitude from the time of the Pilgrim Fathers to the present day. The colonists not only denied the right of a representative body to tax those who were not, but those who were represented and asserted fundamental rights with which no legislature, however democratic or representative, could interfere. It is this denial of all sovereignty which gives its profound and permanent interest to the American Revolution. The Pilgrim Fathers crossed the Atlantic to escape from sovereign power. Washington called it a monster. The professor of American history at Oxford called it a bugaboo. And Mr. Lansing writes of the Peace Conference that 9/10 of all international difficulties arise out of the problem of sovereignty and the so-called sovereign state." Now, the fact that they avoided the very word sovereignty as well as the idea is significant. The U.S. Constitution is the only constitution in the modern world that avoids the very word sovereignty. And it was because they denied the doctrine of the sovereignty of any state or of man simply because they believed in the sovereignty of God. This is an important fact. The background of it is feudalism. Now, the minute you mention the word feudalism, it's amusing sometimes the reaction you do get, because we have been brainwashed by our education, and feudalism is a dirty word in terms of modern education. But really, the word feudalism and federalism are basically the same concepts. Feudalism indeed has a long history in Europe, and it's easy to go to the history of feudalism and pick out a great many ugly facts. But many of them, of course, are not true. And with the others, there is no history that is not without its unhappy aspects. Serfdom, by the way, was not a product of feudalism. Serfdom was a product of the Roman Empire. How did serfdom, and it's interesting to digress there a moment because it's a very significant fact, how did serfdom develop? Well, as Rome increased in its statism, taxation grew heavier and heavier, until finally it was no longer possible to own property. You were taxed out of existence. You paid so much in taxes that after you bought a piece of property, you were paying more than the payments in taxes each month. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Now, what happened? Well, finally, a lot of the farmers in Italy, and it started with them, said, this is no good. We're not landowners, we're renters. Let's sell out to the big politicians. They have an in with the government as far as taxes are concerned. So finally, all of Italy was reduced to serfdom, because the small farmer, who hadn't been wiped out already by taxes, sold out or handed his property over to a big politician and said, you take care of me, and I'll work the land. And it'll be yours, you'll get a percentage of it, and I'll get my living off. And finally, just a handful of politicians owned all of the rural land in Italy. And this began to spread throughout the empire. This is how serfdom started, because taxes became a second purchase of property. And you are paying more in taxes than you paid to buy the property. This created serfdom. Feudalism gradually eliminated serfdom. What was feudalism? Well, feudalism was decentralized civil government. It meant that the basic authority rested in the local township, or in the city, or in the alods, the independent farmers, or in the local lord and his serfs. Each of these units represented a semi-independent government, and most of the authority of government rested on the local level and not on the national level, so that the king was relatively weak and he was under law. He was a constitutional monarch. He was not, under feudalism, an absolute monarch. It was decentralized government. And the basic document, when you have any history of American constitutionalism, of course, is Magna Carta, is it not? And what is Magna Carta but a feudal document? What happened? Well, the barons and people of England did not like the tendency of the crown to royal absolutism, to what later came to be the divine right of king, toward a non-constitutional monarchy. And so they cornered King John and they said, we demand that you agree to our old feudal rights. And those old feudal rights were embodied in Magna Carta, and many of them came right down into the U.S. Constitution. It'd be interesting to trace some of them, but we don't have time. Now, feudal Europe, because it was Christian, was hostile to the idea of sovereignty. And all government was contractual or constitutional. Hence, the idea of sovereignty is not at all present in medieval Europe. They believe that God alone is sovereign. Therefore, government cannot claim sovereignty. Civil government. Now, the minute the colonists came to the United States, they insisted on establishing what was a Protestant feudal restoration. I go into this in This Independent Republic. I have a chapter entitled Feudalism and Federalism, as well as dealing with it elsewhere, and I also deal with it in my new book, which just came out a week ago today, The Nature of the American System. But they were concerned with making what had been the basic unit in feudalism, the county, again, the basic unit of American civil government. And your criminal law and your civil law are basically county law. And your basic tax, the property tax, is a county tax. Because this is the basic unit of government. Not the state and not the federal government. The county. This is feudalism. And this is federalism. But there is no sovereignty in this structure. It is a system of governments because we are not under one government, one civil government in the United States. We are under a system of governments, none of which have sovereignty. Sovereignty is reserved to God. And therefore, God's law is over all forms of government. And this means constitutionalism. That man is under law, not under the state. So that government of, by, and for the people does not mean popular sovereignty or the sovereignty of the state. Second, it does not mean democracy. The Constitution is clearly anti-democratic. And there is one clause in the Constitution which forever forbids the United States from becoming a democracy. They'll never be able to change that. What is it? Well, the Constitution says that the Senate, with representation of two senators from each state, cannot be changed in its nature without the consent of every state. And can you see the day when Nevada will say, all right, we'll be content with one senator, and California can have 10? It'll never happen. The consent of all the states is required to change the nature of the Senate. So that by this simple clause, the founding fathers put a permanent bar in the way of democracy. Moreover, as the Federalist Papers show, they were very definitely anti-democratic because they did not trust in man. Hamilton, in number 34 of the Federalist Papers, said, "The fiery and destructive passions of war rage in the human breast with much more powerful sway than the mild and beneficent sentiment of peace. And that to model our political systems upon speculations of lasting tranquility is to calculate on the weaker springs of the human character." In other words, man is a sinner and he cannot be trusted. And if you're going to assume that man is naturally good, Hamilton said, you're in for trouble. And Hamilton went on further to say that any form of government is limited in its ability to accomplish things. And he warned against, and I quote, "the chimerical pursuit of a perfect plan. I never expect to see a perfect work from imperfect man." And again, a very significant statement. The Constitution, therefore, was premised on the basis that man is a sinner and that you're never going to have a perfect world. But you can have a godly society which is under law. It is the characteristic of every socialistic form of government that it strives after perfection, not after law and order. When you strive for law and order, you are protecting the godly citizen. When you strive after perfection, you are compelling everyone to fit into a mold which is established by a group of planks. The Constitution was established in terms of we the people. And Madison said, the ultimate authority, wherever the derivative may be found, rests in the people alone. And the Constitution set out to make the people strong and the state or the federal union strong. In other words, there is to be a strong civil government and a strong people, because they felt that to have a weak federal union would make the people lawless. To make the federal government strong, but not to make the people strong in their rights, was to make the federal government dangerous. So they took pains to make both strong. And hence, to balance one against the other, and meanwhile to have checks and balances within the Constitution, the three branches of the federal government, and the checks and balances one against the other, the states as a check against the federal union, and the counties as a check against both. There was, therefore, you see, a balanced system of governments and of checks. Now, this was taken very, very seriously by the founding fathers. And we read, for example, in the Federalist Papers, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. In other words, men are sinners. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. In other words, land itself has constitutional rights. So that the reapportionment scheme is clearly against what the founding fathers intended. The constitutional rights of the place. This is in the Federalist Papers, number 51. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human government? If men were perfect, you wouldn't need a state. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. That's pretty plain speaking. But it's amazing how people will perversely insist on misreading this. I spoke at one university a couple of years ago with two professors. And one of the professors from this area maintained that Federalist Paper number 51 gave to the federal government unlimited power. Now, how can you read unlimited power in that wording? This is very obviously hostile to democracy and the democratic state, and hostile to unlimited powers. Strictly limited powers, anti-democratic, insisting on the supremacy of law, because neither man nor the state can be trusted. And democracy means the sovereignty of man and faith in man and trust in man. This is government of, by, and for the people in terms of godly law and order. Third, the equation of government with the state. We saw earlier that Murray said the United States has a structure of governments operating on different levels. And he referred here to civil government, local, county, state, and federal. Each of these decentralized and characterized by checks and balances. And as I pointed out, in this structure, the county is the central, and that branch of state which is closest to the people. And James M. Beck, who was Solicitor General of the U.S. in the 1920s, said the principle of local rule was basic to the framers of the Constitution. And he added that they had a contempt for mere phrase-making as well as an adherence to realities. However, this different levels of government which makes up the American system goes deeper, far deeper than the federal, state, and county levels of government. When we go back to the beginnings, as early as the 1630s in Massachusetts, we find that when they talked about government, they did not mean the state. And this was not meant until the end of the 18th century. About the time of the constitutional settlement, the language began to change. But when people in colonial and also for a time in early constitutional America spoke of government, they meant the self-government of the Christian man. This to them was government. And this is, of course, the basic government, is it not? Every time you use the word government, and every time as you read these writers, you find the word government. They are talking about self-government. Taking care of yourself, minding your own business. This for them was the first and the basic government of society. The second basic government was the family. And the family is a government, is it not? And a very important government. The family is, after all, man's first school, his first church, his first state. And it is an exceedingly important government. Third, the church is a government. Again, an important government. Not only in its structure, officers, and the fact that you submit yourself to its discipline and its authority, but that it governs you by its teachings. Fourth, schools are an important area of government. And education is an all-important area of government. One, by the way, which we have handed over lock, stock, and barrel to the state with devastating consequences. I was delighted this last week to pick up on the newsstand a science fiction magazine. I never read science fiction, but this had an editorial that I wanted. The editor there has an editorial. It's in the August 1965 issue of Analog. And he defines education in four words. He says, education is simply slavery. He goes on to say not all slavery is bad. A great deal of it is very good, and many slaves, in fact, most slaves in history, have been happy with their slave owners. And he said, what is education but to commit yourself, your whole will, your whole life to somebody to be shaped? That's an important point. And if you're going to turn yourself over to the state, to be shaped. The state is going to make you the slave of the state. That's why I believe in independent Christian schools. Because the child belongs to the parents, not to the state. Now, to continue with our analysis of the forms of government, we have the self-government of the Christian man, we have the family, we have the church, we have the school, and fifth, business, trade, commerce. This is an important area of government. Every man who is in business is governed by the business, by the laws of economics, by the law of supply and demand, by the requirements of his particular type of business. This is a very real government, and it's the most important government that most men have to deal with day after day. It governs not only their income, but their time, and a great many other things in their lives. Sixth, private associations are an important kind of government. Whenever we move into any circle, we are governed by that circle. Every organization you belong to, the neighborhood you live in, the part of the country you are in, all these things govern you, because you don't want to be an oddball. You want to conform within reason to a community, and communities do govern you to an amazing degree. I was interested some years ago when I went back east and was in one community speaking. I was very pleased with one young minister I met, and I commented to my host and hostess on what a very fine young man he was, and thoroughly conservative. "Well, yes," they said. I said, "Well, am I wrong? I have found all his doctrines thoroughly conservative, and I found his political and economic ideas sound. I didn't detect anything radical or liberal in him." Well, what? Well, he goes around during the week with colored shirts. Now, in many parts of the East, this constitutes radicalism, you see, and no doubt he became a conservative after a while, because he was new there. He'd come from California, and he hadn't learned yet to be governed by the expectations of the community. He didn't conform. Now, we are governed by these things far more than we are often ready to admit. So that private associations are a very real government. And private associations can include organizations like this, which govern you as individuals in your ideas and in your opinions, and also govern by their influence on a community. And Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book Democracy in America, written about 130 some years ago, said that private associations were perhaps one of the most powerful forms of government in the United States, if not the most powerful. Then, seventh and finally, you come to the state or civil government, which is one form of government among many. I'd like to spend a whole morning just on this doctrine of government, and I'm just giving you a brief synopsis of a talk on it, because it's important to this idea of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But you can see what's happened to our language. And it was the deists at the end of the 18th century who began this switch. Because up until then, people were talking about the state as civil government. They never talked about it merely as government. But little by little, this change was introduced into the language, and then finally into the state itself, and what is happening today, or what has happened. Civil government, the state says, we are government. They have equated the state with government, so now they say, since we are the government, We have a right to govern private associations, who you integrate with or segregate from. We have a right to govern your business. We are the government. And we have a right to govern your schools. In fact, we've taken them over. Your church, and it's entering the church far more than you realize. Your family, and you. The state now is government. But this was not so. For the state to call itself government is to usurp all other areas of government and enter or invade them. And the founding fathers felt so strongly about this that although by the doctrine of express powers the Bill of Rights was already in the Constitution, and state after state they said, we will not ratify unless this is spelled out. What the Bill of Rights spells out is simply this, that the federal union has no business not only in the states and in the counties, but in your self-government, in your family, in the government of your church, and in the government of your school, or of your business, or of your private associations. That's the meaning of the Bill of Rights. It says that the civil government is just one area of government among many. So that to speak of government of, by, and for the people is to say that government does not mean the state. It is of the people, basically. It is the people, therefore, who comprise the essence of government in all their various activities, personal, familistic, religious, business, and private. Let us then analyze the relationship of people with the state. From the time of the First Continental Congress through Lincoln. The Declaration and Resolves of the First Continental Congress, October 14, 1774, declared that the inhabitants of the English colonies in North America are entitled to life, liberty, and property, and they have never ceded to any foreign power whatever a right to dispose of either without their consent. And again, on July 6, 1775, in a declaration of the causes and necessity of taking up arms, they said, our forefathers, inhabitants of the island of Great Britain, left their native land to seek on these shores a residence for civil and religious freedom. The Declaration of Independence further spelled this out. The Declaration, by the way, is a feudal document. What does it say? The contract or constitution between the several states and the King of England, their feudal monarch, is declared null and void because he has violated the contract or constitution. The king was claiming to be an absolute monarch, and they said, oh no, you're not. Every one of us are independent states. We have no connection with England. Our only connection is that we share a common monarch, and you are our feudal monarch. This is the meaning of the Declaration. It has no legal significance if feudalism was not the case. But it had legal validity because their relationship by their charters with the King of England was strictly feudal. He had become an absolute monarch in England, but he had never become an absolute monarch in the colonies. Parliament had taken over the royal absolutism, and after the Glorious Revolution of 1688 was exercising it. but never in the colonies. Today, Parliament has the right, and Sir Hartley Shawcross stated it before Parliament, and I cite it in this independent republic, that Parliament has the right and the absolute power to declare that all blue-eyed babies can be destroyed at birth. Because Parliament has sovereignty. In other words, it has absolute power. But there is no sovereignty in the Constitution. The Declaration denied that there was any sovereignty in the King of England. It was feudal, contractual, and therefore null and void on violation. And they declared that because that the relationship was null and void in the Declaration because of his repeated injuries and violations, both of their civil and non-civil governmental powers, and that an arbitrary government had replaced the colonial free system of English laws, and the boundaries of this arbitrary government had been enlarged with a design to introduce absolute rule into these colonies. They were fighting against the doctrine of sovereignty. They were fighting against absolutism. Well, by way of reaction, of course, they created the weak state of the Articles of Confederation, and they realized this was wrong, and therefore they established the strong state of the Federal Union and the strong powers of the individuals. And Chancellor James Kent, one of the great constitutional authorities of about 130 or 40 years ago, said of the Bill of Rights, "The rights of persons in private life are either absolute, being such as belong to individuals in a single unconnected state, or relative, being those which arise from the civil and domestic relations." This means, in other words, that the state cannot touch the person. He has certain areas of governmental powers which are forever beyond the federal government or any civil government. Now, this is what the great constitutional lawyer said about 30 years or so after the Constitution was written. And there wasn't a person living who disagreed with him. They all assumed that to be the case. When did the change begin to take place? Well, it was in the 1840s. And it was reflected in the party platforms. Recently, I sat down and read through all the party platforms through the Civil War of all the parties, including the very minor parties. And it's startling to see how, after 1840, suddenly this change manifests itself. And where did it come from? Well, the answer is also very, very obvious, from Unitarianism. Unitarianism was the first major and greatest continuing subversive movement in the United States. It was Unitarianism that aimed at the state control of education, and I deal with that in both in the Nature of American System, and there are portions of it, of course, traced in Messianic Character of American Education. Unitarianism was aiming at two things: to destroy Orthodox Christianity and to introduce socialism, and to replace a distrust of man and the state with a trust, and to look to the state for the happy resolution of all man's problems. The state has all the answers. This was their faith. And it's interesting to see what happened. Immediately, all the parties began by attacking the past. You would think that they would have looked back to the glorious period of the early years of the Republic and said, we stand for what our forefathers stood for. But they began to kick them in the shin, so to speak. And the Federalist Party, for example, which had been dead for about 40 years, suddenly the National Democracy Party in 1844 was attacked. Now this is a curious thing. It meant simply the rejection of the past. And so in that platform of 1844, the creed and practice of federalism under whatever name or form is denounced as an imposture and as too monstrous for the popular credulity. Earlier, they had begun by declaring their belief in the limited powers of governments derived solely from the Constitution. But now they began their platform in 1844 by placing their trust in man, in a clear reliance on the intelligence, patriotism, and the discriminating justice of the American masses, if you please. They were talking about the masses and their trust in the masses. Not only so, but they began to say by 1844 too that human brotherhood is a cardinal doctrine of true democracy. This was the Liberty Party. And it went on to enunciate all the programs of world brotherhood and love and peace and light very quickly. The minor parties in particular. They were equalitarian. And the Liberal Party program spoke of its doctrines as indispensably necessary to the salvation of the Union of the States. Now, by 1848, the parties have gone so far that the Democratic platform, and mind you, the Democrats were then the conservatives, declared thus in their platform, resolved that in view of the recent development of the grand political truth of the sovereignty of the people and their capacity and power for self-government, which is prostrating thrones and erecting republics on the ruins of despotism in the old world, we feel that a high and sacred duty is devolved with increasing responsibility upon the Democratic Party of this country as the party of the people to sustain and advance among us constitutional liberty, equality, and fraternity, and so on. Now this is a startling fact. They began by affirming their belief in the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. These were Marxist socialist revolutions, with all kinds of subversive and illuminist movements engineering them. And the Conservative Party begins by affirming its belief in those revolutions and using the slogan of the French Revolution, liberty, fraternity, equality, as though this were constitutionalism. A tremendous change had taken place. And the source of this change was Unitarianism. The Free Soil Platform, by the way, of 1848 demanded the entrance of the federal government into new areas, river and harbor improvements, road construction, and the like. Every president through the Civil War, with one exception, believed that such a program was unconstitutional. But the Free Soil Platform of 1848 began to demand. Now in 1852, the Democrats won with Franklin Pierce. and were very, very upset and disappointed with him, as just about everybody in the country was. He was a political dark horse, and he turned out to be a constitutionalist and conservative. And they didn't even bother to run him again. They were glad to be rid of him when the 4 years were over. And all you hear about in the textbooks is what a weak, weak president Franklin Pierce was, and Buchanan as well. Well, I believe they were both great presidents and thoroughgoing constitutionalists. That's why they're not popular in the history books. Pierce faced a tremendous barrage immediately. But his purpose, he said, was to avoid disunion or civil war and to pursue a course of strict constitutionalism. And he is called a failure because his administration succeeded in doing this. He warned in his fourth annual message, December the 2nd, 1856, and I quote, "Extremes beget extremes," and he warned against indoctrination, against in reciprocal hatred and extension of federal powers as unconstitutional. And he said, "The several states of the Union are by force of the Constitution co-equal in domestic legislative power. Congress cannot change a law of domestic relation in the state of Maine. No more can it in the state of Missouri. Any statute which proposes to do this is a mere nullity. It takes away no right, it confers none." Pierce then turned to the slavery question. And everybody was demanding that he do something to abolish slavery. And they accused him of being pro-slavery, which he was not, because he refused to allow any federal intervention into the question. And he condemned the approach of federal intervention, and I quote, "as contrary to all the fundamental doctrines and principles of civil liberty and self-government." Then he went on to analyze why he was against the federal government doing anything about it. He raised the question, and I think what he had to say here is so important that we need to analyze it with a special care. Is it the fact that in all the unsettled regions of the United States, if emigration be left free to act in this respect for itself, without legal prohibitions on either side, that slave labor will spontaneously go everywhere in preference to free labor? Is it the fact that the peculiar domestic institutions of the southern states possess relatively so much vigor that wheresoever an avenue is freely opened to all the world, they will penetrate to the exclusion of those of the northern states? Is it the fact that the former enjoy, compared with the latter, such irresistibly superior vitality, independent of climate, soil, and all other accidental circumstances, as to be able to produce the supposed result in spite of the assumed moral and natural obstacles to its accomplishment, and of the more numerous population of the northern states? The argument of those who advocate the enactment of new laws of restriction and condemn the repeal of old ones, in effect avers that their particular views of government have no self-extending or self-sustaining power of their own, and will go nowhere unless forced by act of Congress. And if Congress do but pause for a moment in the policy of stern coercion, if it venture to try the experiment of leading men to judge for themselves what institutions will best suit them, if it be not strained up to perpetual legislative exertion on this point, if Congress proceed thus to act in the very spirit of liberty, it is at once charged with aiming to extend slave labor to all the new territories of the United States. Of course, these imputations on the intentions of Congress in this respect, conceived as they were in prejudice and disseminated in passion, are utterly destitute of any justification in the nature of things, and contrary to all the fundamental doctrines and principles of civil liberty and self-government. Now, what was Pierce saying? Very simply this. You men claim you believe in liberty and in freedom. You don't. You're demanding that the federal government abolish slavery. In other words, you say that the only answer is not a free answer, but a statist answer. And you're saying that slavery is economically superior to freedom. He said, I don't believe it. And I don't believe that a free competition between slavery and a free labor is going to do anything but destroy slavery. In other words, perpetual legislative exertion, he said, is not the answer. And it is a dangerous kind of answer. In other words, slave labor is not able to compete with free labor. Leave it alone. Time will destroy it without destroying the Constitution. He was right. Already there were Southerners writing that slavery was not economical. And although this is not in the textbooks, there was only one state in the South that was pro-slavery, South Carolina. In every other state, they were against slavery. They would like to have abolished it as soon as they had an answer, what shall we do with the slaves? And if somebody had come up with the answer with that in Washington, slavery would have disappeared everywhere except in South Carolina overnight. After all, only one in 18 white voters in the South was a slave owner. And if you want to know where slavery was the most unpopular during the Civil War, go South and study the Southern documents. Why? Well, the slaves stayed home and ate well, and all the white men went to war. And if that wasn't unpopular, you're kidding yourselves. It was up north where some of the slaves were fleeing that slavery was popular, and the northerners were bitterly anti-Negro. They were not against slavery, they were against disunion. Pierce was right. Slavery was increasingly in disfavor in the South. It came at this time within one vote of being abolished in Virginia. But Pierce's answer was constitutional. His trust was, as he said, in the very spirit of liberty. Economics, he believed, was an area of government, and a free economic order would abolish slavery. But to bring in the state into this, he felt, was to destroy constitutionalism. Well, the current was running against Pierce. Meanwhile, there was a young politician in Illinois whose thinking it is very important to understand, because he too, like Pierce, was picked as a dark horse. The Republican Party was the party of the radicals, the statists. And the young Lincoln had been very much at many a point on their side. We don't have time now to trace the history of his thinking. He had begun as a Whig. He had been very much anti-slavery and for a time had made basic to his perspective not constitutionalism, but he had continually talked in terms of the Declaration of Independence. Now, this was a very significant fact, because young Lincoln, although a lawyer, was confusing what was a statement of ideals in the beginning, all men are created equal, and he misunderstood the sense in which it was said in his earlier writings, with a legal fact. And an ideal cannot be made into a legal fact, can it? But progressively, Lincoln came to recognize that the statist answer was not the answer. And he came to oppose unlimited universal suffrage. Before he was a candidate, he came out clearly against abolitionism, against Negro suffrage. What he did favor was the universal right of self-government. And he interpreted all men are created equal in this sense, that all men have the right to govern themselves. But he said this does not mean in our constitutional government that all men have the right to vote. As a result, when Lincoln was elected, although the South was desperately afraid of his party, Alexander Hamilton Stephens, who became the vice president of the Confederacy, and who had been Lincoln's closest friend in Congress, told the Southerners, "Lincoln is a good conservative man now. We have nothing to fear from him." The South, however, was afraid of his party and had reason to fear his party. Lincoln, as president, was faced not only with the war, but also a war with his party. The time is growing late, and we don't have time to analyze that. But he hoped first to resettle Negroes elsewhere. He made it clear that by people he meant the white citizenry of the country, that created equal meant created equally free to govern themselves in their private affairs as free men, personally, but not necessarily politically. And it was in this sense that at Gettysburg he declared, "The proposition upon which this nation was established was precisely this, and expressed the hope that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Self-government was basic to his perspective. Lincoln was a disappointment to the radical Republicans, and his plan for Reconstruction, peaceful Reconstruction, meant the immediate re-entrance of the Southerners into the Union. It meant a program for resettlement of the Negroes, and legislation was passed to that effect. Very few people realize this. And it was signed by Lincoln to begin the resettlement. But unfortunately, the document had not been affixed with a seal at the time that it was passed, and so it was null and void. And no legislation was subsequently repassed because of his assassination. With his assassination, however, the radical Republicans quickly seized power. Johnson proved to be, this was Andrew Johnson, of course, a thoroughgoing constitutionalist and conservative. But he did not have the power in Congress that Lincoln had. Enough of the congressmen had come into office as a result of Lincoln's landslide victory, and therefore they were indebted to him for their re-election, and he could control them. This was not the case with Johnson. And so the Civil Rights Bill of March 1866 was passed. Perpetual legislative exertion. Precisely that which Pierce had warned against became the order of the day. And the Civil Rights Bill of March 1866 gave the federal government vast powers over the states. And the federal government and president had powers on discretion to intervene in the states if they shall have reason to believe that offenses have been or are likely to be committed against the provisions of this act. That's a literal quotation. Not merely violations of the Civil Rights Bill, but if the federal government decided that anyone thought they'd like to commit it, they had right to move in. No crime was necessary for the president to invade an area, only his assumption that it was possible. And the federal government had the power to use all the military forces, and I'm quoting literally, as shall be necessary to prevent the violation and enforce the due execution of this act. President Andrew Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Bill, declaring it is another step, or rather stride, towards centralization and the concentration of all legislative power in the national government. What was planned at that time, and the Civil Rights Bill of 1866 was a major step towards it, was to create a centralized statist power in Washington. There's no mistaking it. The legislation was clear-cut. Not even our Civil Rights Bill of last year was as radical as the Civil Rights Bill of 1866. Johnson, at the sacrifice of his own career, stemmed the tide. And Hayes completed the work. But the country had been sacked by the forces of Unitarianism. And after the Civil War, these forces made rapid inroads into the churches. By 1899 and 1900, it was so far gone that a book such as Charles Ferguson, the Reverend Charles Ferguson's The Religion of Democracy, could be written, and it was hailed as a great book. I have found no critics of it in reading the reviews of the period, and it went through many editions. What did the book say? Simply this: the United States must work for a world democracy. This is the true meaning of America. We must, moreover, have a world church. And who will belong to this church? Every man who is born. There can be no creed, no standard, no bar of admission to anyone. The one world church and the one world state was clearly affirmed. And this was to be the great dream to be realized in the 20th century. Now, it is not surprising that these ideas arose. They were commonplace from the Enlightenment on. You can find them going so far back as Dante, who was an advocate of these things too, by the way. One of the great subversives of history, whose face now adorns one of our postage stamps. And he believed in communism. very definitely. He affirmed it in the Divine Comedy. You weren't taught this in school, of course. But the fact that is shocking was this, that by 1900, a book could be written advocating these ideas, and the churches did not rise up and protest. It was assumed to be a marvelous and an idealistic expression of the American creed. The resistance has only come in since World War I. It has rapidly mounted since World War II. You represent a part of that resistance because you truly believe that government of, by, and for the people begins with the self-government of the Christian man, that to God alone belongs dominion, that sovereignty is an attribute of God and not of man, and that government does not mean the state. That the state has only a small area of government that it can call its own. This is the American perspective. This is constitutionalism. It is now under attack. But for the first time in many, many years, there is a major resistance to these deeply entrenched forces of subversion. I believe that the forces of subversion have never been more frightened than they are today. They have never had the resistance that they have had in recent years. I believe the resistance will continue to mount. And the foundation of it will be Christian faith. The background of constitutionalism was the higher law concept, Christianity. It was Unitarianism that subverted constitutionalism and Christianity. And it will only be as we undo that subversion by going back to Christian faith and constitutionalism that this can be once again a truly independent republic. Thank you.